It's a delight to be with you today, and I'm speaking on a topic that I'm guessing most of you have not encountered during your the meetings you've attended on creationism, and hopefully it will stimulate your thinking today. To me, it's a very important issue for Christians to understand. And I believe God's given us a very, very powerful apologetic on this topic of language. The goal of my talk today is to help you grasp better the profound role of language in every aspect of what God has created. And in so doing, hopefully help you also to come away with a richer and deeper understanding of God Himself. I'm persuaded that the astonishing role of language in the world around us is an irrefutable argument for God's existence. And moreover, the phenomenon of language indisputably falsifies the fundamental assumption on which philosophical naturalism is based, namely, that there are no non-material realities. Language falsifies that very, very dramatically. Because language is such an integral aspect of our own mental processes, most of us never pause to consider just what is occurring when we think, write, speak, or interpret what others, what we read or hear others say. Therefore, a crucial first step in this discussion is to establish very clearly what the term language entails. So, just what is language? Well, I'm going to give you primarily the definition of what is called formal language, what linguists understand language to be at its most essential level. So language involves first an assignment of meaning to a set of otherwise arbitrary symbols to form a vocabulary. And secondly, a set of rules by which elements from the vocabulary may be joined together to create arbitrarily complex meaning structures. Now, I'll unpack that in the next several slides. So if you're struggling a little bit to follow what I'm trying to say here, be patient. But basically, language encodes meaning. Language is an encoding of meaning. And it uses a set of symbols or words and a set of rules. So an example of assignment of meaning to symbols, in this case sounds, are as follows. There is a certain meaning associated with these sounds. These sounds are arbitrary. They have nothing to do with the meaning. So you have among humans today on Earth, we have the sound dog. This a certain meaning assigned to the sound dog, or hund, or hien, or sobaka, or kane, or perro, or gao. Okay, in all cases, the same meaning is being assigned. The symbol is arbitrary. And doing this for a large range of different meanings leads to a vocabulary. All right, so that's one step in understanding what language entails. And then an example of joining vocabulary elements or symbols or words together to form a more complex meaning structure is the following. The guide dog led the blind girl through the city traffic. So here we see multiple symbols being joined together according to a set of rules in the English language to produce a more complex meaning structure. There's a moderate level of complexity in this sentence, describing, it's a description of a certain phenomenon, certain event. So But this general description of what language is broad. It not only includes human spoken language, it also includes human written language, and even human sign language. It includes computer languages of every type. It includes the field of mathematics, and it also includes genetic language. All of these different types of language are described according to those two criteria that I just gave. So now I want to ask the following. Is language a material phenomenon? Is it a material reality? And the answer is no, because meaning, which is what language encodes, the basic essence of what language is an abstract quantity. So because meaning is abstract, language is also abstract and non-material. And the non-materiality of language is affirmed by the fact that the meaning a message conveys does not depend on its material carrier. A language, if reliably encoded and transmitted, is the same, whether it is via paper and ink, on a magnetic disc, or on a plastic CD, or chiseled on a rock. It's the message, it's the meaning that is the essence of a language structure. So therefore, language belongs to a non-material category of reality. Again, a message, when reliably transmitted, is identical whether it is carried by acoustic waves through the air, relayed electronically, and actually what you're hearing is a combination of that. Some of it is my just pure voice going through the air. It's being augmented electronically through the PA system. It's still identical whether the message is faxed, email, encrypted, sent through the mail on a CD or a DVD, or carried via smoke signals. The message has an identity and a reality independent of its material carrier. Again, language conveys meaning. Language encodes meaning. Language expresses meaning. The essence of language is the meaning it conveys. Because meaning is a non-material entity, so is language in its ultimate essence as well. Are some of you wanting to take notes? Are you trying to get a little light?
Yeah. Well, I want to be able to see you.
Oh, you want to be able to see me. Okay. Okay. Hopefully that. I think there's enough contrast for you to see this. Now, actually, Einstein himself recognized this situation. He recognized that there exists a logically, what he called a logically unbridgeable gulf between the realm of concepts and propositions, that is, of language, and the realm of what we see, hear, taste, and touch, that is, what is physical. And so here's a quote from Einstein, 1944. He said, "We have the habit of combining certain concepts and conceptual relations so definitely with certain sense experiences that we do not become conscious of the gulf, logically unbridgeable, which separates the world of sensory experiences from the world of concepts and propositions." So it's a little complicated language there, but basically he's making this point that there is a logically unbridgeable gulf between concepts, linguistic entities, and the physical world that we experience through our senses. Today, linguists refer to this gulf, which Einstein described, between the physical world and the realm of concepts as the Einstein Gulf. So in linguistic circles, what Einstein described is well appreciated. I want to illustrate this concept, this Einstein Gulf. A bodily thing, such as a dog shown on the left, exists on the side opposite the Einstein Gulf from the word dog, which can be used to refer to the dog. The two entities are in separate categories of reality. The word is not a dog, and the dog is not a word. So is that, are you tracking with me? And moreover, language profoundly shapes the world around us. And I want to try to show you that almost every aspect of what we experience, see around us, has language as a very important component, very important aspect of what it is. Our thoughts and plans as humans certainly involve language. Language enables human institutions, indeed all aspects of human society, our telecommunication and transportation networks, our institutions of government, finance, industry, business, education, defense, and agriculture, and so on, all rely critically on linguistic interactions among us at many levels. So basically, the complexity of human society is very much enabled by language. Moreover, that same kind of almost universal penetration of language is true in the machines that we build today. Language, as we've defined it, includes not only ordinary human languages, but also machine or computer languages. Software utilizing machine language enables machines to perform tasks hardly dreamed of a century ago, or I would say even 20 years ago. Software, via the meaning it carries, enables the complex electronic circuitry and computer chips to perform astonishing feats. Without the software, the hardware would accomplish nothing useful. But enabled by software, the circuitry in our smartphones, for example, allows us to place calls to a good fraction of the world's inhabitants, can provide detailed navigation instructions for driving in a strange city, can recognize our speech, can search the web to provide verbal answers to our spoken questions. It can interpret speech from someone with a language different from our own and almost instantly translate it verbally into our own language. Perform all these feats. And but it's only because of the software, of the linguistic software, that all of that is possible. And in addition, machine language expressed in the software of industrial robots enables these robots to fashion and assemble most of the parts required in our automobiles and many of the other machines and appliances we use. The power of this non-material encoded meaning to shape the material world around us almost exceeds what we can imagine. So the way our automobiles today come into existence very heavily relies on language, the machine language, and all the numerically controlled machines that create the parts that go together to make the autos. Even the robots that weld the body together, paint the car, and assemble many of the parts. So here's a photo of some robots in the assembled Chrysler and Dodge minivans at a plant in Ontario. So we've never visited a place like that. But it's just astonishing how machines now do what humans used to do not that long ago in building things like automobiles. Here this vehicle is being welded together at a General Motors assembly plant in Michigan. So we've mentioned human language and machine language. I also mentioned mathematics. So how does mathematics qualify as language? Yes, it does. It's because it involves assignment of meaning to sets of symbols and specification of a set of rules or axioms for manipulating the symbols. So there's a pretty significant implication of the fact that mathematics is language. The fact that mathematics is language implies that the laws of physics are a linguistic description of the structure of the material world. That the material world has itself has linguistic underpinnings. I know most of you haven't seen these equations before. They're Maxwell's equations, very elegant equations that describe the phenomenon of light or electromagnetic radiation. So just a relatively small number of symbols describe this phenomenon of electromagnetic phenomena, electromagnetic waves. Just an example. But here we have a linguistic description of this phenomenon of light, and in fact all kinds of electromagnetic phenomena. So that shows that there is a linguistic description of these phenomena. And every aspect that physicists and chemists have been able to work out, it basically those laws that have been worked out represent linguistic descriptions of the basics of the reality that we observe around us. In other words, the material realm has linguistic, that is, non-material underpinnings. This implies that the material realm cannot be fully explained or understood solely in terms of material entities. And these linguistic aspects also cry out for explanation. So I'll just say that, atheists feel smug and, well, they insist that everything that exists is material. And yet they're very much aware of the laws of nature, but somehow it's oblivious that they need to account also, if they're going to try to account for what is without God, they've also got to account for the laws of nature, and which are crucial, I would say, in accounting for what really is. A lot of these considerations, can philosophical naturalism possibly be true? Philosophical naturalism it really came into prominence during the Enlightenment at the end of the 18th century. Basically, that was an atheist movement. And the claim was being made that everything is material. That the physical laws that had been worked out by that point by people like Newton, it showed how the physical world worked, and you could think of, many people were looking at the physical world as just a giant machine that ran according to these physical laws, and so it was. Many people jump to the conclusion we don't need God as an explanation any longer. So this idea that there is no non-material reality took hold and has become prominent and basically is the prevailing outlook in most academic circles today. But we have just shown that language, which is encoded meaning, is indeed non-material and also quite real. And so I would say here we have a very glaring counterexample to this proposition that there are no non-material realities. So can philosophical naturalism be true? The answer is an emphatic no. Language represents an unambiguous counterexample to the assertion that matter plus energy in all its various forms is the full extent of what is real. Only one counterexample is sufficient to satisfy that claim, and language is a very prominent counterexample. So I would say, as Christians, there's no need to be intimidated by philosophical naturalism. There's no sense even to give any place for it. It's so obviously false. It's so obvious. It's so easy to demonstrate as being foolishness. This means that naturalism, which has been taught as dogma in most of the world's universities for the past century or more, is indefensible from an intellectual standpoint. So I would say we should not tolerate it being taught in our public schools, should not tolerate it being advanced in the public square. It should be challenged. I believe it's so easy to do that these days. Still, some might be asking, is it possible that language might have a material cause? Somehow, the language might have a material cause. And I would say the short answer is no, it cannot. The laws of chemistry and physics offer no clue whatever that matter can assign meaning or otherwise deal with meaning, even at the most rudimentary level. Even when matter is organized in extremely complex ways, such as in electronic networks with trillions of interconnected transistors, there's no hint, in the absence of software, of any ability whatever for that complex structure to generate meaning-bearing signals or behavior. So indeed, some of the computer processors, like the i7 chip, is approaching a billion processors. You can easily connect many of these together to get networks of trillions of transistors, interconnected transistors. Back when I was working at Los Alamos, we bought a computer system from a company in Boston called Thinking Machines Corporation. They built what they call the connection machine. And the founder and president of that company truly believed that they were on the verge of producing machine intelligence, a machine that could think on its own. And as a Christian, to me it was complete absurdity. But there were people, I mentioned this guy, it's very serious, built a significant size company, very much driven by that idea. And while that idea was somewhat popular back in the 80s and 90s, you don't hear much about it anymore. That you're going to, by putting together complicated networks, that somehow intelligence is going to spontaneously spring forth. But that was believed, that has been believed by many people in recent times. Well, what about random processes? Can they possibly generate language? Well, I wrote a little program, I don't know, probably 10 or 15 years ago, that generated random sequences of characters. And I used the frequency of the characters that corresponded to English, to the English language. And I also added spaces in addition to the 26 letters of the English alphabet. So here's an output from that little program, 800 characters, random characters. And you can judge for yourself how much, if there are meaning-bearing English words here. You know, there are a few places where some short words appear, like or. Let's see, where are some others?
NASA. You got teeth.
You have NASA.
No.
That's a
Yeah. But as far as conveying any kind of meaning as such, it's impossible. Basically, if you start introducing, changing, to take a meaning-bearing sequence of letters and start randomly changing them, basically you change that meaning-bearing text into gibberish. That's just the reality of things. So I say that language then, because it's non-material, requires a non-material explanation. And the laws of physics offer no indication whatever that matter has any language generation capacity. Neither do theoretical explanations exist for how matter conceivably could behave to allow linguistic capacity to emerge. That word has been used that if you connect enough transistors together in a big enough network, that intelligence will emerge. Well, there's no evidence at all, whatever, that such a thing happens. And it should be clear if one understands the nature of language and understands that it's a non-material phenomenon. You wouldn't expect material things to be able to produce something that's non-material. Okay. Now, our own language ability demonstrates that we possess non-material attributes as human beings. So naturalism, in excluding non-material reality of any sort, also insists that we as human beings can possess non-material faculties or attributes. Yet the observation that language is non-material and that we as human beings so readily use language and even create new languages for our computers should cause us instantly to reject this very restricted view of ourselves. Our language ability demonstrates that we possess obvious and profoundly significant non-material capacities within ourselves. Our language ability implies that we are dramatically more than a complex assemblage of atoms, as naturalist philosophy would have us believe. And as millions of children are being indoctrinated to believe that that's all they are. From our own experience, we discover that our capacities to think, reason, make choices are all involved in how we form and interpret language. And I would submit that indeed thinking apart from language is impossible. It's hard for us to imagine being able to think without employing language. So language is very much intertwined with who we are as human beings. Because the case is so strong that material causes are incapable of generating non-material effects, the human use of language provides compelling support for the conclusion that our mental faculties that enable us to generate and process language must also be non-material. The biblical picture that human beings basically are a soul and spirit inhabiting a physical body is strongly supported by these conclusions we've just considered, and that we indeed are at the very essence of who we are. That we are non-material beings. I learned, let me just credit a friend of mine. His name is John R. Aller. He's still, he's a professor of linguistics, currently at University of Louisiana. When I knew him, he was a linguistics professor at the University of New Mexico when I was working in New Mexico. And I want to credit him for introducing me to many of these ideas that I've been sharing with you. And one thing I, 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 I'm, I'm really caught my attention. He was insisting that language gives humans close to God-like power. He said that most people do not realize that the power that language provides them. So here, language ability confers almost God-like power. It is the capacity that sets us apart from the rest of the animal world. It enables us to create the sort of complex society that we see all around us.